Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham. And after several years, I looked it up. June of 2021 was the last time this guest was with us. It is Dominic Broomfield McHugh. Hi, Dominic. How are you?
Hi, I'm very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Last time you were here, is you were promoting your Meredith Willson book, The Big Parade, which was a fantastic book. I would recommend it. And we're actually going to touch on it real briefly a little further on in the conversation, because Meredith Willson is going to pop up in our conversation today. But you are back because you have another new book out called The Letters of Frank Lesser, which you have edited along with Cliff Eisen for Yale University Press. It's a very thick book of the letters of Frank Lesser, which was a very interesting read for those of you who have never read a collection of letters by anyone. I kind of want to first, before we actually get into the content of the book, which is fascinating because it's more than just information about Frank Lesser's musicals. A lot of it is about Frank Lesser's life. And one of the great things about reading books that are compilations of people's letters is that you get a real kind of a candid glimpse at them, because you get a lot of personal correspondence where they're kind of joking and things with friends, sometimes letters to their housekeeper in this case, and there's also business correspondence. So you get kind of all different aspects of the person's life. So you get a kind of a real three-dimensional look at the person, which is interesting. But it's more than just the musicals of Frank Lesser. It's also the big business side of Frank Lesser, which was a huge part of his life, was the businesses that he ran. But just in general, when it comes to putting together a book that's a compendium of letters and correspondence from someone, it's a big undertaking, because it's not just, I think there's probably some reader, the listeners out there who just think that it's, oh, well, you gather all their letters and you just kind of reprint them and shove them in a book. It's not like that at all. So tell us what it's all about. How did this particular book come about? And what is the process of what goes into putting a book like this together? Because it's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work.
It is
a lot of work. So this one came about when I had finished the first book of this kind that I worked on. This is a third one. The second one was Cole Porter. Mm-hmm. And then the first one was Alan J. Lerner, who wrote My Fair Lady. And I got the proofs of the My Fair Lady book around the time that I was in New York visiting a guy called Joseph Weiss, a wonderful man who used to run the Frank Lesser and Julie Stein estates. So he would oversee those catalogues. Mm-hmm. And we were chatting about my Lesser book, and he was very surprised. And he said, is there an audience for that? Is there a readership for that? And I said, oh, yeah. And then he pulled out this folder of letters of Frank Lesser, and said, would you be interested in doing something with these? So it started there, with him going, here's some great ones that we have. And I sort of said to him, well, do you have Frank Sinatra? And he pulls open a drawer and brings out a letter about Frank Sinatra. And do you have Marlon Brando? And he does. So it was clear from that point that this was going to be great. It was complicated. Each of these projects has its own challenges because of what material has survived or not. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Lesser, there was a huge amount of business correspondence because he was meticulous in keeping carbon copies of everything. And there's a fair amount of personal correspondence, letters to his brother, things like that. What there isn't a huge amount of is letters about the moment-to-moment writing of his musicals. And it's not that untypical. We have this problem with Rodgers and Hammerstein as well. People tend to get together and write together, and therefore not write to each other. So we would love to read letters between Frank Lesser and Ray Bolger about Where's Charlie, but there's only one or two. And it's probably because they never existed, but it's tricky. So the first thing one had to do was to look at what there was and then go finding more to kind of fill in the gaps. For example, in this case, there was a big folder of letters between Lesser and his brother at the conservatory where his brother taught. So, for example, they had some stuff that we could then use. So we went looking and we looked in Hollywood and you went to the Library of Congress. It's this sort of thing. So then you have to gather and then you go, what kind of story does this tell? And how are we going to represent other parts of the story that can't be represented through letters? Sometimes these kinds of books are simply the letters with a few footnotes, but this, for all three of these books, we've created some narrative between the letters to try and help the reader along and kind of understand what you're going to read next. So kind of bringing all that together was a bit tricky. So it did take over a decade to do it, during which time I published, you know, 8 other books, including the Cole Porter letters, but it's certainly been a journey.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, in some cases, it's in some situations, because you have some correspondence from one person, it's almost like you're, in some cases, it's almost like you're listening to one half of a phone conversation. Like you're listening to one side of a phone conversation in the sense that you've got the letters from one person, but you don't necessarily have the letters from the person they're corresponding with. So you kind of have to piece the puzzle together a little bit, which you do, you know, an excellent job of that in the book, because you have correspondence, but you fill in kind of the context historically as to what it's going on and what the letters are about and the background as to what the letters are about. And the book is heavily footnoted so that whenever any names are mentioned of any celebrities, no matter how well known or not known at all, you footnote them so that people know exactly, well, here's the person that they reference someone. So here's a footnote as to who that person is, or a situation, or an event or something. You make sure to footnote it so that people can fill in the blanks, because that's the only way you can really navigate letters like this, because you just, there's always going to be missing pieces. It's like a big jigsaw puzzle of a person's life through letters when you've got missing pieces to the puzzle. So you have to pull out from other resources to fill in those pieces, right?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, and if you think about it, the book would be literally twice as long if we included, even if we had all that other correspondence.
Right.
It would be like 2 volumes then, because you'd have all of the back and forth. And there comes a point where a lot of the responses from the other side are not exclusively about Frank Lesser or about the topic that Lesser is writing about. So in some cases, we experimented with including some of the responses or the other side. And actually, it didn't necessarily make it clearer or more interesting. But then there's an exchange with Moss Hart that's just very charming. For example, the guy that wrote the screenplay to Hans Christian Andersen, of which Lesser wrote the songs. And there's some back and forth there because both sides are witty and charming. And they're just kind of, they're just being pleasant with one another. So
right,
that was
right.
Nice to include. But sometimes the responses would be just so full of unnecessary, unhelpful stuff that we needed to move the story along. And as you know, from having read the book, Lesser wrote some quite long letters, some of them go into a lot of detail. So to then get the other side of that would have been too much.
Yes,
so
exactly.
It's about providing all of that lesser-based sources, really, and trying to use autobiographies or quotes from newspaper articles or just filling in what HUAC is. When a movie was in production, one can convey that quite quickly without seeing necessarily the other side. So that's what we've tried to do. It's tricky though.
Yeah, and I think you made a really valid point when you said that in the time frame that this was all happening, especially when it comes to the creation of the musicals, the collaborative work was often and usually done in person. And also, you're dealing with someone who was, since he wrote music and lyrics, he wasn't working with another person like Rodgers and Hammerstein or Rodgers and Hart or Compton and Green. There were not 2 people who were necessarily working with each other on anything, but they were usually, even in those cases, they were generally working together in person. So you wouldn't have correspondence, you know, but you got to imagine, you know, 50 years from now, if people are writing books or putting together books of the collaborative efforts of people who are working today, they're going to now have the ability to use emails and text records and things like that, because it's done much more remotely now. than it was back in those days. Back in those days, the collaborative effort was done in person, much more so.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was all about these communities. And the other thing, of course, is that people had telephones.
Right.
You know, in the middle of the 20th century. In fact, the telephone was a big thing to have. And so if your collaborators were in New York, which they often were, and you were living in New York, you could phone them up if you needed to discuss something. So you wouldn't spend an hour dictating a letter to someone that's living a few blocks away or even 100 blocks away, because you can just call them. So, there is something particular about this creative climate at that point that was a bit different. But it causes gaps in storytelling that maybe we would love to hear some agony about how Guys and Dolls was written. And that stuff either doesn't exist or has mostly been lost. But then on the other hand, he talks in quite a lot of letters about how he thinks that the songs from Guys and Dolls work. There's a number of letters in which he gives advice to young songwriters or just people he's mentoring and says, you know, think of this kind of song in My Fair Lady or West Side Story or Guys and Dolls or Where Charlie. And he would cite a song and he would sort of explain how Adelaide's Lament works and is created. So in a way, it's not the end of the world. And there's some lovely letters about the movie Guys and Dolls and about shenanigans that were going on behind the scenes there that aren't so much about writing it, but making that movie happen was clearly a challenging experience for quite specific reasons.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think comes through is, and I think people are aware of this anyway, if they're aware of Frank Lesser, is the fact that they think to themselves, well, he wasn't very prolific when it came to Broadway musicals because he didn't really write that many. I mean, we know of Where's Charlie and then Guys and Dolls, and we know of Most Happy Fella and How to Succeed and the flop Green Willow. And then that's kind of it. It wasn't like he was pumping out musicals. But when you read the book, you understand why. And talk about that, because you get a real great understanding in the book of how busy this guy was. His life was so consumed with, well, first off, you have to remember he started writing for the movies because he was writing songs for film. Before he ventured off to Broadway to do Where's Charlie, he was a very successful songwriter in film. But he also was a businessman and started companies. I mean, he started Frank Music Theater International,
and then Frank Productions.
Yeah,
there would be other companies underneath those companies. So he was running things across multiple offices and running all these teams of people. And as you say, in the letters, we can see how stuck in he was. He was like, "I want to see this contract." Or here's three pages of clauses that I want you to write into legalese to put into this contract, because I want to own these orchestrations, and the orchestrator may not refer to them as their composition. They may refer to themselves as the orchestrator, but they may not call themselves an arranger. All very, very specific stuff. And as the book goes on and as his career goes on, you can see that he's learnt from being burnt by earlier things, whereby he's saying, okay, it's How to Succeed now, you know, his final major successful work. And that's where all of the stipulations are quite specific, because he really knows how to do that now because he's been doing this for over a decade. But and as it goes on, he's sort of adding more and more, and then helping the other people that he's publishing, producing, mentoring to think about their work in those ways too, rather than giving away their entire life just because they're so glad someone wants to produce their show. It's very, very unusual, striking. I'd never seen this kind of revelation before. And I think it's interesting because maybe you have to be a bit into musicals to understand why this is a revelation. But the idea of it being so business oriented and of being able to see that on the page, and of these people being so focused on all of the legal and contractual aspects of it, and also thinking about how to promote and market things as well, The whole thing is so much more clinical, or perhaps the inspiration is in the business direction as well as the work itself. One imagines the challenge of art being creating the art, but it's actually the contracts and the agreements and the teams and the personalities trying to bring it all together. And one can see from this why he managed to get such big names under his fold in terms of his publishing company and his production company and MTI, is because he would really fight for his people and he really knew what he was talking about.
Right, especially considering it's not like he had the training or came from this background. But he was very forward thinking. I mean, he was always, I mean, when you read the letters and all of his correspondence that you just talked about, it's all about preserving the rights and the profitability going forward for these songwriters and making sure, not just for himself, but for any of the songwriters that were under his umbrella, basically, to make sure that their rights were being protected and that their work was being protected. And it's just, and it's so eye-opening to see, because you just don't, I don't really remember of any other person in musical theater history who had that kind of thing going on. I mean, I know Julie Stein did a little bit of some of this kind of stuff too, because he also was a Broadway producer in a way, but not to the extent that Frank Lesser was doing it, which ultimately then explains why he had these huge gaps between Broadway shows. Because when you read the book, it's amazing he had time to write any Broadway shows. He was so busy with all this business stuff going on, you know, and it kept him with a lot of money coming in, and it seemed to keep him happy, because the thing that I really liked about the book is you really got the sense that he got enjoyment out of this. And you get a sense of, he doesn't seem to be this kind of fervently driven person who is like, I've got to have another hit show. He seems to be more driven about not only, I guess, success on his own, but he also wants to have success for other people.
Mm. Oh, right? he loved the domain, didn't he?
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of showbiz.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be in the center of making all this activity happen and make my people flourish. And there's such a sense of the team in the office where mm-hmm. he worked, with all these, Harold Orenstein and the lawyers and the secretaries and the rights people and the sort of junior producers, and Stu Ostro, who went on to become a major producer on his own mm-hmm. right. You know, there's all these other people going on, and the dynamic with them, it has so much chemistry going on. And he clearly loved coming up with things. And there's also some letters, which I'm sure some people will have read them and thought, why have they included this? But he comes up with ideas for glass pitchers and all of these, how to create random objects that companies could sell. Or he would read something in a newspaper and think, could we use that? Or how can we do something with this idea? How can we make an idea? It really is remarkable how the imagination and the energy are so mm-hmm. fertile. He just never stopped working. And in terms of his productivity, the career looks a bit odd, because he actually wrote a lot of songs from the 30s mm-hmm. through to the mid-40s, mostly one-offs for films or small numbers of songs for movies that maybe don't have profile. And then he starts with Where's Charlie, Guys and Dolls, Hans Christian Andersen is just 2 years later in Hollywood. There's then a long gap to The Most Happy Fella in 56, so a four-year gap. But in a way, that's because that was a three-act show, very difficult to write. We get a lot of a sense in the letters of how he's daunted by that he's trying to raise the bar for himself. He could just write something commercial. People were trying to get him to do something that was just an adaptation of something famous or something fluffy. He wanted to write this operatic thing. So it's not that there's nothing. He also had this project, Dream People, he spent quite a bit of time working on with Dori Sherry, and that was completely abandoned after quite a lot of work, and then Green Willow 1960, and then How to Succeed 61. So he's not entirely lazy with the productivity. I think having a flop and then having something that was abandoned also makes the picture kind of look against him compared to Rodgers and Hammerstein, who just seem to be able to do it once every 2 years without fail, sometimes more often than that. But yeah, it's interesting. Of course, R&H themselves were producers, but I think what you're saying is that whereas they were clearly the figureheads of their company and would be involved to some extent, and of course they produced Annie Get Your Gun for Irving Berlin in 1946, into the 50s they really shifted into mainly producing their own work because they owed too much tax by having hits as producers of other people's work, and it was taking too much time. So then they focus on the R&H catalogue, whereas Lesser does the opposite. He writes Guys and Dolls, it becomes his signature hit, and then he starts putting all these tentacles out through that show and through his back catalogue to create these companies that then allow him to bring on these younger figures.
Backtrack a little tiny bit to talk about, because you mentioned it a little bit yourself, which is his brother Arthur. Because there's quite a bit of correspondence between him and his brother. Talk about who, because I don't know that a lot of people even know that he had a brother, and that his brother was successful in his own right and was also in music. But talk about who Arthur was and the relationship there, because there's a lot of correspondence between the two. And there was obviously an interesting tight relationship between the two of them.
Yeah. So Lesser's father died when Lesser was still a child. And this made life difficult for the family. And Frank's brother, Arthur, who was older, started to make a name for himself as a concert pianist. And so he went out into the world and started making money playing the piano and teaching, and became particularly famous as a teacher in conservatory settings, very top ones, and then wrote a book called Men, Women and Pianos, which became a famous book about pianists and the culture of piano playing. But in that period after their father had died, Frank and his mother relied on Arthur financially, and Arthur very much stepped up and would send money home to them so that they could live. And when Frank was trying to get his songwriting career off the ground, there were a lot of false starts. He had an instinct for it, but then it would not work. And so he would go off and do some other job and then be drawn back to it and then fail again and then go off and do some other job. And during this time, Arthur was very supportive. So then once Frank had launched himself successfully and become a hit, then for the rest of his life, he was incredibly grateful to Arthur and always acknowledged and was very close to Arthur and acknowledged that Arthur was the reason why he'd managed to make it, really. It was because it allowed him to just keep eating and living, that there wasn't that pressure to go off and do absolutely anything for the sake of earning money. And we see later on that Frank would send Arthur presents, or he would, you know, book him into a hotel or treat him to something. There is so much affection between the two of them, and particularly from Frank's side to Arthur's side. That's what's very striking to me, because Arthur was also clearly super fond of Frank, but it's not quite the same sort of all-embracing, uncompromising, I would do anything for you because you did so much for me kind of thing. And I think it really shows a helpfully human side to Frank, because that loyalty is so strong and manifest in every sentence, that if Arthur wanted something, then Frank would try to do it. And he would just go, oh, I've started using this new brand of razor blades, so I'm sending you some, or whatever. It would be that as well. It would be just, I want you to have a good life, because obviously Lesser ended up a millionaire as a result of all of this combination of songwriting plus production plus being a publisher, whereas Arthur would have been comfortably off and was successful, but not in the same way. So there is that sense of sharing in a sensitive way that is just really striking.
Yeah, I got the same thing. I was really kind of touched by the whole story there, because it's kind of woven throughout the book, because throughout the book, Arthur pops up. The letters to Arthur and the correspondence between the two of them keeps popping up throughout the book. It's heavier in the beginning, obviously, because of the start, but it keeps popping up, and you see this kind of eternal gratitude that Frank has towards him, because he just feels as though, I never would be where I am if it wasn't for the fact that you were supporting me and Mom way back when we had nothing. And you were the one out there making all the money, and you were sending it back to us. And I would never have been able to have the chance to explore what I wanted to explore. And I love the part where Arthur's book comes out and Frank has bought all these copies and is like gifting it to every music person he knows. And Arthur's almost, I think, a little embarrassed by it, because he's like giving it as a gift. He's giving it a gift to all these accomplished musicians. Like, here's the book my brother wrote about pianos, piano players. it's really adorable.
He sends a copy to Andre Previn, doesn't he, for example. I remember that one particularly. But, you know, it was a major book.
Yeah,
when, you know, it was printed in large quantities, and people really knew what it was, and it was very much reviewed in the mainstream. So it wasn't just like some little academic project.
Right,
it was a big
deal.
I
just thought it was really touching that Frank was like, I'm going to buy, you know, all these copies of the book, and I'm going to give it as a gift to people.
Yeah.
And I could almost see Arthur kind of going, hey, you know. Because it's just so charming that he did that. But to talk about the other thing I really thought was interesting was the whole section, because I don't want to touch on everything in the book, because there is so much in the book to cover, and I want readers to get out there and purchase and read for themselves so they can discover all the little tidbits in there, because there's a lot in this book that will be new to people. But the whole kind of midsection of the book in the 50s going into the 60s is really fascinating, especially I knew some of it, but I didn't know the depths of his championing of Adler and Ross. I mean, the team who wrote Pajama Game and Damn Yankees back to back. But even before then, he was plugging away and promoting them to everybody he possibly could. I mean, getting them out to Los Angeles to meet with the studio heads. I mean, I especially loved the series of letters you have after they've been out in Hollywood, thanking each of the different studio heads for meeting with them. And, you know, I think they're wonderful, and I'm sure you could tell that they were wonderful, and I hope you'll sign them, or at least sign them to write some songs for your movies. He is plugging away with Adler and Ross to get them jobs. I mean, it's just, and eventually lands them a gig, you know, writing for John Murray Anderson's Almanac, the review show on Broadway, before the Pajama Game. But talk a little bit about that, the relationship, because it also gets kind of funny, because there's a little bit of contract demand stuff that goes on. That's kind of interesting that happens.
Yeah, they become like mini Lessers.
They do, which I thought was very, very funny.
And in the end, yeah. So it's kind of the case that Lesser almost made Adler and Ross.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that they had no ability or that they weren't working before, because they did have ability and they were working before. But he sort of took them as really obscure people and turned them into people who won Tony Awards in consecutive years, and then the movie versions of those stage musicals became major movies as well, particularly Pajama Game with Doris Day. And they were only in their 20s when all of this was happening. And this really shows Lesser's ability to recognize talent, but also recognize the conditions in which something could be exploited commercially. So it's not just that they're good, but it's that the kind of thing that they can do maybe fits into the culture in that moment with the kinds of things that were trendy or could be trendy. And then he goes, okay, we need to find them suitable material and kind of launch them. And so what he does is to try and replicate his own career, which, as you say, is to take them to the West Coast, introduce them to all the studios and say, what about having these people write a score for your next musical? And in one case, there seems to have been a specific discussion about them writing Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which they didn't do in the end. But I had never heard that they were in the running for that job. But it's clear that they might have been. And as we know, Seven Brides was a kind of a B-movie that MGM didn't regard that as being one of their A-list releases. This was not Singing in the Rain. This was, you know, a kind of secondary kind of thing with a lower budget. So you can imagine in those circumstances how promising new people might have been hired to write a score. And so he almost pulled it off, didn't quite. And then he gets them to land some songs on Broadway. And then suddenly they're writing The Pajama Game. And so the trajectory within a couple of years from meeting them to getting them that gig is astonishing. And then they become demanding because they get drunk on success and they think they're always going to have it. And you can see not only is he sort of arguing with them about contractual demands, for example, they wanted a room with a piano in which they could write their work and it would be in his offices. So he was going to have to, you know, make this space for them. And then they wanted to be able to choose the piano. And Lesser says, absolutely, don't let them choose our piano for us. So there's a kind of ridiculous tension going on. But the thing that that really strikes me is there's a letter where he's received the songs for Damn Yankees, which is their second book musical. And he's going, but listen, guys, you've written these songs before because they're all... You've done similar things in The Pajama Game, and I'm not saying that they're exactly the same, but can you take a more critical eye to this work? And he's sort of giving them the specifics then of why some of the songs like Heart or What Lola Wants, why they need to be improved. And so there's then tension about that. And then Pajama Game goes to London and Jerry Ross dies in his late 20s. So he creates these people and then the team falls apart in completely extraordinary circumstances. And so what an encounter. But it's so clear from these letters that they are the people where Lesser is the brains behind what they did. And as we know, Richard Adler tried many times to have another hit and never really did. He did stuff. He wrote music and lyrics for some TV musicals and for some Broadway shows. He never had another hit.
that whole section is just, it's fascinating because you also get to see, not only do you get to see the fact that he recognizes the talent and he's basically nurturing the talent from an artistic level when you, especially when he talks about them, the way he presents the comparison between Damn Yankees and Pajama Game is he's basically saying, look, I think the songs from Damn Yankees that you've written for Damn Yankees are excellent. However, be prepared because critics are going to say, whatever Lola wants sounds like Hernando's Hideaway. It sounds like you're repeating yourself. And I just want you to be aware that that's the attack that's going to happen. So you may want to rethink how you're writing some of these songs because they sound like you're repeating songs from the previous show. And he's like, but don't get me wrong. I think they're wonderful songs. He's trying to be diplomatic about it to kind of get them to think about it from an artistic standpoint. But at the same time, when they're doing Pajama Game and Damn Yankees, you also get to see the letters he's writing from a commercial business perspective of trying to line up major recording artists to sing some of the songs from the shows before the shows open to get the publicity out there, to get the songs out in the public, recorded by big name artists before the shows open to get the familiarity out there. He's working all the angles, you know, to really make these shows hits, which ultimately they both were huge successes, obviously. They won the Tony Awards for Best Musical in consecutive years. So that whole section is just fascinating to watch him nurturing them and pushing them out to Hollywood and the Seven Brides piece and then the John Murray Anderson Almanac piece and then watching the Pajama Game Damn Yankee section. It's just fascinating to see, especially when you can see, and you can see from his perspective, there's nothing villainous about anything he's doing. He's really doing it because he believes in these guys and he really thinks that they're talented and he really wants them to succeed. He just doesn't want them to pick their own damn piano on his dime. He's sort of like, we're going to get a piano, but we want someone who knows pianos to pick a piano, and here's the most they can spend on a piano. We're not going to spend more than this amount of money on a piano. He's sort of like the father figure they need to keep them under control. It's a fascinating section.
And he does have an autocratic streak. So he's a great collaborator, but he does want to be the boss. I think that tone, I mean, he is the boss.
He is the boss.
That underpins much of the correspondence, in fact. And I think that's the problem with them is that they thought they were the boss. And it must have been very difficult when they actually succeeded twice in a row and it all went so well. It's hard to say, but you need me. Like, it's like the gypsy moment, isn't it? Where she goes, I made you. Like, you know, how can you? Frank's turn, you know. I think that this must have been very difficult for him. I do have a letter somewhere, which we haven't included in the book. But Adler and Ross drafted a letter to fire Lesser, essentially, as their publisher, and it says on the letter, not sent. So clearly they considered withdrawing from him, and then I think there was probably conversation and it sort of, they managed to get everything back together again. But there was definitely a learning experience there for Lesser, which was, be careful how you nurture young people, because actually it can backfire on you even when they succeed.
Yes, they become the rebellious teenagers.
They do.
Yes, they do. Now, speaking of interesting relationships, let's talk about his relationship with Meredith Willson, which was the subject of your Big Parade book. Now, it's I think it's pretty well known that he encouraged Meredith Willson to write The Music Man. I think that's kind of a pretty well-known story. But talk a little bit about that, but then talk about, there were some things there that I had not known about at all. I was shocked to read that letter, the letter where he came up with the concept of the Music Man TV series, where he was, that was before the movie rights had even been sold. He was like proposing that they turn the Music Man into a television series, where they basically had Harold Hill going from every episode was a new town and a new woman that he was like, I mean, it was just so It was so odd. And I just, I read, but it was his mind working at how do I make this into a longer life property and stuff. But talk about his relationship with Meredith Willson, because it also gets a little bumpy there. It gets bumpy after a while, you know?
Yeah, his relationships with a few people, quite a lot of people got bumpy, I think. Frank was Frank, and therefore, I think that doesn't always go down well with people. The combination of the two of them seems interesting to me. They clearly knew each other from the 40s. Meredith Willson recorded Lesser's wartime song, Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. I think that was 1942. And so they must have known each other at least from that time. They were not very similar, though, in so many ways. You know, Frank has this Jewish background. He he's full of wisecracks. He has a particular philosophy of the family, which I don't think is necessarily the same as Wilson's. They see different Americas. The Music Man and Molly Brown are very much set in the Midwest kind of community. And then Guys and Dolls is very New York. So Lesser is much more of an urban kind of person when he's writing in successful mode anyway, both with that and How to Succeed. So they're dissimilar in some ways. Lesser clearly really admired Wilson's abilities and believed that he had a great musical in him. And the Music Man proved that to be the case. And clearly the mentoring was very strong because, you know, Wilson managed to dig into something personal in order to bring out something very distinctive in that work that was original and innovative. But in a way, the relationship went in a bit of the same direction as with Adler and Ross, i.e. he went on to write The Unsinkable Molly Brown. And then he starts becoming demanding of Frank Lesser in terms of their agreements and contracts, because Lesser had this role as his publisher and sometimes as a co-producer of his shows. And Wilson sort of started thinking, where's the money going? And so he orders an audit of all the accounts to see where the money's going, and sort of basically accuses Lesser of stealing money and cooking the books. And Lesser manages to pull him up on it and say, look, this is ridiculous. We're friends. If you don't want to work with me, that's fine, but can we remember that we're human beings and not get this out of hand? The other thing is that sometimes Wilson would have an idea for a show. So, for example, I seem to remember that Lesser takes very badly to the idea of a sequel to The Music Man, The Son of the Music Man. And it's clear.
When I saw that title, I was like, The Son of the Music Man? Really?
Yeah. It's clear that they discussed that in person and that Wilson said, hey, Frank, I've been working on this idea for a sequel. And Frank went, oh, no. And that the outcome of that was that Wilson was a bit frustrated with him. And so then Lesser writes back and says, well, you know, the reason I was frustrated is because I wasn't really sure what you were talking about or how it was going to work. And so I'm not saying no, but is a sequel really going to work? And so he's always there trying to offering him advice. And this continues right through to 1491 with Lesser and Wilson, where Lesser is trying to offer Wilson support on this dreadful musical about Christopher Columbus that ends up a huge flop. But he's trying to help him make it better and offers feedback on the books. There's very, very specific detailed feedback on the books of Unsinkable Molly Brown, Here's Love, and 1491. It's interesting because one of the sort of gossipy things that's out there is whether Lesser wrote certain songs by Wilson and by Adler and Ross. And I don't think there's any evidence at all that that's the case. But there's plenty of evidence of Lesser having creative input in the form of ideas and critical feedback. And so I feel that the book sort of nuances that gossip and says, well, hey, they really were reliant on Lesser in a big way, but it doesn't mean he sat down and just gave them a song that he wrote. I mean, maybe he did, but having seen the manuscripts of The Music Man, they're all in Meredith Willson's hand. You can see that he wrote My White Knight, for example. So maybe Lesser chatted to him about it, but I don't think there's anything that suggests that he had that kind of relationship. The relationship is more, I don't think this is working. Or he would go to a preview of the Unsinkable Molly Brown and give a detailed account of what's not working.
Right.
And would make suggestions, but he wouldn't go, here is a new version of the book, or here's a new score. Or
right. And I think it's one of the things that's funny is that earlier on in the book, isn't it when he's giving advice to Adler and Ross? I think it's Adler and Ross he's giving advice to early on, where he's talking about keeping the focus in the correct me if I'm wrong, but he brings up Miracle on 34th Street, where he talks
is it
Adler and Ross where he's talking? Is he talking to Adler and Ross about something? Anyway, he brings up Miracle on 34th Street and says, the audience doesn't really care about what's going on between Maureen O'Hara and John Payne. They really want to get back to Santa Claus. They don't really care about what's going on between the two of them. They're really more concerned about getting Edmund Gwynn, who plays Santa Claus, back on screen. And then sure enough, you know, like 2 decades later or 15 years later, here we have Meredith Willson doing a musical version, which kind of has the same problems.
Yeah, I found the letter. It's to an actor called Hume Cronin.
Oh, that's what it was. It was Hume Cronin,
He clearly had an idea for a musical. And Lesser says, did you ever see a picture called The Miracle on 34th Street? Can you remember anything that happened between the young man and the young lady involved?
Right,
If they had 20 hit songs to sing, you wouldn't have had any more fun with them. So then all these years later, Wilson clearly thought that we could have more fun with them, but he was wrong.
Yes. Yeah, I just thought that was an interesting little foreshadowing of something that was going to come up, was going to land on his plate indirectly through Meredith Willson. So let's talk a little bit about, because it has brought up, it's popped up a couple times in our chat, Green Willow. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and I think also revealing in the letters of him kind of, because I thought the letters about Most Happy Fellow were really interesting, because you could see that he really was into the challenge of writing Most Happy Fellow because it was something different. He wanted something different. He wanted to do something operatic. He wanted to do something. It was big. You know, he was sending his wife to Italy to see opera singers. It's just, you know, and they were like really trying to, and it took a long time for him to write it. But you could see that I got the sense that he was struggling a bit with Green Willow from the beginning. It was sort of like, he really wanted to make it work, but there was just this kind of roadblock that he kept hitting with Green Willow. He eventually got there, but then ultimately, once it opened, even though the cast was good, his score was good, it just wasn't something that was meant to be a musical. And I think the critics all agreed. And I think ultimately you can see in his letters where he is sort of apologizing to the author of the original book that it just was never meant to be a musical. And he kind of accepts it. I mean, he sort of accepts that I was wrong. Sort of like, it just wasn't meant to be. It's just an interesting section.
It reminds me in a funny way of Dear World, Jerry Herman's musicalization of The Madwoman of Shiloh, where there's something very particular about the style of the original story.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a Broadway composer, to come up with something that puts it into song, and sort of lifts it into another kind of style, or comes up with a style musically that works for the style of this quirky story, is quite difficult. And I think that that's it with Green Willow, is that the story itself is a bit complicated to sort of translate into another form, especially when Lesser's big thing is being rather sharp-edged. Mm-hmm. I mean, the two great works are Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed.
Yeah.
And although there's wonderful ballads in Guys and Dolls, in both of them, really, it's about making fun of people. It's about jokes. It's about showing us human life in a kind of heightened form and helping us to laugh at human life and to show how the structures of society are problematic and cause all these tensions, and we all go along with them and we organize ourselves according to archetypes. But then you get a story like Green Willow, where there's sort of different names for everyday objects, and there's a whole different vocabulary for things, and yeah, I feel like he couldn't get into it. And then he needed a strong book writer to maybe help him figure it out, and he didn't have one. And maybe it needed stronger direction. Ultimately, though, it just doesn't belong to him. And it is interesting. There's this correspondence with BJ Shute called Joy, where she tries to help and says, well, the problem is that you didn't refer to the bakery, or this wasn't the right word for this object. And he says, well, I just think the whole thing is terrible. It's very nice of you, but, you know, I should never have done this. And thereafter, he from time to time refers to it as a failure. And he uses it to acknowledge that he could really fail. Mm-hmm. And it was the first big failure, because Where's Charlie, Guys and Dolls, Most Happy Fella had all been successful, and Hans Christian Andersen was successful, and even the movies on the whole, for which he'd written songs, you know, most of them did reasonably well. Maybe not so much that Let's Dance with Betty Hutton and Fred Astaire, but, you know, even that, there was no shame in any of that work. But here we are with Green Willow, it loses a lot of money, it gets terrible reviews, not so good. So it is interesting that there's a change of direction, and it introduces his final decade, because he died in 69. It introduces his final decade with sort of saying, I can fail. And although he went on to write How to Succeed and it won the Pulitzer Prize, everything else he did either didn't come about or flopped, really.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of a downward spiral there, where he's no longer on top of popular culture, because music is changing, society is changing, civil rights is coming in, second wave feminism is coming in. This is a different landscape, and he's getting a bit behind, really.
Yeah.
And he clearly doesn't know how to respond to it, and How to Succeed is almost like a fluke hit. Like, it's so brilliant, it can't not be a hit. But it's not part of a wider view of this is how style should be now,
right?
Because actually,
exactly,
he didn't have Burt Bacharach music in him, for example, or he didn't have hair in him, and then he starts thinking about producing very different kinds of shows, like Wait a Minim, or he tries going in different directions, but it's not working in the same
way.
Well,
it's not really part of him. I mean,
no,
he's really Golden Age Hollywood and Golden Age Broadway is really what he is, you know. But it's interesting, because even those letters in the correspondence in the last part of the book, he's still, you know, he died, he was only 59 when he passed away from lung cancer, but he's still humorous and sharp, and he's still, you know, he's still on the game. He may not artistically or creatively necessarily still be in the game, but he certainly still has, he's still Frank Lesser, you know, and that still comes across in the letters. As I said, the book is fascinating to read, and there's so much in there to get into, which I don't want to do, because we've just barely scratched the surface with what we've talked about. But before we leave, I want to ask you, what, since you have spent so many years working on this book and you've read so many of the letters, what were some of the biggest surprises or most interesting things that you discovered as you were combing through all this correspondence? What really jumped out at you that you were not expecting to find?
Well, we have covered some of them. The stuff about Adler and Ross really surprised me. I hadn't appreciated there was so much tension between him and Frank Sinatra, who of course is the star of the Guys and Dolls movie. And we understand that he really wanted to play Sky, but Marlon Brando was hired instead, so he had to be Nathan. And then new songs are written for him, and there's a sort of attempt to accommodate him. And the letters show that he clearly, I think he didn't like the song Adelaide, which was written for him. And then there's a revelation that Frank Lesser and Frank Sinatra disagreed over how to perform it. So then there's tension between them. And it seems like Sinatra basically didn't value Lesser as a writer other than of Guys and Dolls, despite the fact that he was a kind of a songbook person, a great American songbook person who would record all these albums of all kinds of material. And Lesser would go, well, we've lived without each other all these years, I guess we'll survive. But I really hadn't expected to find that. There's also business about the House Un-American Activities Committee. So there was a revelation or a suggestion that Lesser was a communist, and it happened by mistake. And it was immediately retracted, but it was included in one edition of the Los Angeles Times, I think it was. Or is it the Times or the Examiner? Anyway,
We had both of those papers at that time.
Yeah, I know. Some Los Angeles very good newspaper, I'm sure, got it wrong because they'd been fed information. So Lesser had been named in a HUAC hearing incorrectly and by mistake. But then Lesser describes in this letter to his business manager the lengths he went to make sure that this was quashed immediately and that there was no suggestion that he was a communist, because they were on the eve of signing the deal to turn Guys and Dolls into a movie. And Sam Goldwyn said, hang on a minute, I can't make this movie if this is true. So that to me was a major revelation, actually, because I hadn't really, well, one wouldn't know because he managed to cover it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's those sorts of things that are sort of contextual that really surprised me. Something else I love is there's correspondence about putting the Most Happy Fellow on the London stage. And so problems that Lesser had with the unions and getting permission to take his music director to England and taking certain actors to England and the lengths he goes to with all of that. So there's some great material around that business. I do think, though, that the Meredith Wilson letter that goes on for dozens of pages, where Lesser writes him this long letter to tell him what's wrong with his career, is probably the best.
Yeah.
Maybe the best letter I've ever read, because it's amazing. It's illustrated. He has these little drawings and doodles in it to show what he's talking about. And he goes into great detail to tell Wilson what's wrong with him and how he's managing his career. So that is a highlight, I have to say.
Yeah. So what do you, final question, for the readers out there who are going to pick up this book, which I think is a fantastic holiday gift if you have someone on your list who is a major theater fan. This is a wonderful read for theater lovers. What do you think readers are going to take away from the book?
A snapshot of the business of Broadway. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That really the book's primary contribution is to say, you think that what goes on behind the scenes is romantic, but actually it's far more complicated than you can possibly imagine. And we think of this golden age as this big romantic time when everything was just about the art. And we can see on the page that that's not the case at all.
Yep. I totally agree. And I, like I said, I think what you get, what I got the most out of was what a complex person Frank Lesser was. I mean, I knew he was a master at writing show tunes and writing wonderful musicals like Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed and even Where's Charlie. But when you see what a master businessman he is at running these businesses, but he's also a humorous, generous, protective, funny. It creates a three-dimensional person that you don't really realize is there. It gives you so many different facets of who Frank Lesser really was, which is the real benefit of reading this book. So anyway, Dominic, thank you so much for being here. The book is called The Letters of Frank Lesser, edited by Dominic Broomfield McHugh and Cliff Eisen. Thank you, Dominic, for being here. It's been so nice to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. And Merry Christmas, everyone, when it comes.
Yes, yes. Merry there. Christmas. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays. Bye. Thank you.